listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the show. It's a new week. We're coming on to Monday, and today is August 12th. Looking at the news, a lot of things are happening. It seems like the end of the world is coming soon, but we're going to skip that one today. I have two very exciting guests in the studio. I'm going to introduce them right now. We have Michael Perez Lindsay and Rhett Lindsay. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you so much, Sam. We're so happy to be here at the prestigious LA Talk Radio station.
Well, thank you for being here.
Good morning, sir. Yeah.
Good morning.
Happy to be here.
Thank you very much. And you guys are Catherine's clients, which with Catherine, I got to tell you in advance, she's the clients she deals with and the movies she deals with always end up winning things, you know? So you're in good company, you know? I mean, we've worked with her for years, actually, and she's had some Oscar contenders and everything. So you guys probably know about that, but that's the publicist, and she's good at what she does.
She is. She's a superwoman. Yeah. I cannot give her more credit than she deserves. She's amazing at what she does.
How did you guys discover her? How did you find out about her?
Oh, I think you did.
Yeah, so I like to just go for the gold. And I reached out to her. We had the film already locked, and I knew that we had something that was of quality, and I sent her an email, and it was a cold email. And about 2 weeks later, she responded and said that she watched the film. She fell in love. She cried. And
really?
She wanted to set up a call. And
oh, wow.
Maybe like a couple days later, Mike and I hopped on a Zoom, and we spoke to her and locked in the partnership.
Right.
Sounds good. Sounds good. We're going to talk a lot about your movie, Will I See You Again? I read a little bit about the background of the film, and I saw the trailer, and it seems pretty, like, emotional. You know, I mean, I'm not surprised she cried, you know?
It is emotional. It definitely absolutely is. Yeah. Very deep.
Have you guys been in film for a long time?
I have. I've been in the business for half my life, since I was 16.
So, really?
Yeah, I started as an intern
in
high school at what's now MBS Studios in Manhattan Beach. It was Raleigh Studios back then.
So oh, okay.
High school kid running around the golf cart working on CSI Miami.
That was a beach boy, huh? Manhattan Beach.
Yeah.
That's a place to be, man.
Family settled there in the early 1900s, so
really?
Very fortunate for that, yeah.
Oh, wow. South so there. You have a long history there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Wow.
Very cool. What was it like growing up there? Did you like it?
Yeah.
I mean, it felt like a beach town, right?
It's a beach city. It's like a beach suburb, but it's got more of a slow pace to it.
Right.
And it's a very, pretty diverse community. My family, Mexican-American, my grandmother was born there in 34. So she grew up by the beach. Like, that's the life she knew.
Yeah.
And my father's side of the family, they're like Hawthorne, Torrance, Redondo as well.
Okay.
And so, yeah, both sides of the family grew up in the South Bay area. And so they grew up in that small, close-knit community.
Right.
Because there are a good amount of Mexican-American population in that area of south of L.A.
Oh, okay.
South of LAX. And, that the community was very strong, and a lot of my family members still, they have a lot of friends and from that community and their families and different, generations. As the generations go,
right.
A lot of people stay there because it's such a comfortable, wonderful place to live.
Yeah, it really is. You know, I mean, I go there sometimes to bike. And it's a great place, you know. I mean, really laid-back people and stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
So it's really cool. It's a beach town, yeah. You get that.
There you go.
You get that slower pace, chill vibe, right.
And, Rhett, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh,
and I grew up in the arts, so I was a child actor. And, my mother introduced me to the acting world at a very young age. I was signed to an agent when I was in first grade. And
really?
Yeah. Wow. Did a lot of commercials. had a couple different little industry events that I was part of. And then I did a movie with Martin Lawrence when I was in college called Big Mama's Like Father, Like Son.
And oh, yeah?
I played the role of TJ in that. And, so now I'm a writer. I am an entrepreneur. I have a startup company called CME. And it's about reducing bias in the hiring process. And, it's just been great to partner with my husband and collaborate as filmmakers together on this first venture of Will I See You.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's amazing. What did you have? Did you have a big family in Atlanta when you grew up?
Yeah, yeah. My mother still lives there. I have a sister that still lives there, and some distant relatives and cousins. Most of my family's back in the South. I'm the only one that's really out here, outside of a couple of nieces and nephews that moved here recently.
Yeah. When did you move here? Recently?
I moved here. Oh my gosh, almost a decade ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's home for you now.
It's home. Mm-hmm. Once I graduated from college at the University of Kentucky, I spent a few months back in Atlanta, but then I just decided to, you know, just take the leap of faith and drive out here and find a place, and I have never looked back.
And was that your first time in L.A., or had you been here before?
Been here before, yeah. I used to come here as a kid a lot. My mother had a close friend who worked in the industry. She was a big director. She had daughters that were very highly esteemed actresses at the time. And I used to come here all the time as a kid and visit them on the sets of their shows. And, yeah, I fell in love with acting at a very young age.
Yeah. And you wanted to get into film, and this is where you go, right? You go to L.A.,
you know, I feel like Hollywood. Life takes you down different paths. You know, I went to college. I have a degree. And then I came out here. I worked in recruiting and HR. But I've always been passionate about the arts. And I think what's amazing is that my husband, he is so aligned in his career with working in entertainment in his position. And we almost just simultaneously just connected in terms of, like, our passions. And they aligned well. And we recognize that as writers and as a director and as a creative team, we really have a good sync of each other and our vision of storytelling that we want to tell.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, when did you guys meet? A long time ago?
Oh, that was a long time ago. So 2015, March 2015.
Okay, so you got 9 years under your belt there.
Yeah, we've been together for 9, married for 7.
Oh, wow, congratulations to you.
Thank you, thank you.
That's amazing. You guys are amazing together, you know? I mean, it's really cool.
Thank you.
Really
cool. Yeah, we appreciate
it. I like to see people that have met their soulmate and they're happy, you know? And because sometimes you don't see that, you know? People are like, you know, they get into a marriage and it just goes stale after a while, you know. But it's important, I think, to meet someone that you have a lot in common with and that you guys believe, you know, have similar beliefs and things like that, you know. So so that's pretty cool. How about you? Did you have a big – do you have a big family, siblings?
Oh, yeah. Large family. Yeah. Everyone's from here. So, yeah, for – my mother has 4 siblings. My father has 3 siblings.
Really?
But everyone, you know, lives in the South Bay Area.
So you have a big family.
Yeah, we grew up, you know, our home growing up was the home where we had all the parties. If it was Easter, we had a party. If it was someone's cousin's child, we had a party at our house. And so our home was the kind of the hub usually where the extended family would even come. Any excuse to have a party with a barbecue and a DJ, we did it.
Of course, of course. Do you guys mind me asking how you guys met? How did you
Funny. I came out here for a job interview. I flew out here, and I was out in town in West Hollywood just exploring the city as an adult. So, like I said, I used to come here as a kid. And I was at a bar, and we just crossed paths. But it felt like such a cosmic, like, connection. It just felt like we just saw a kindred spirit, a connection that you haven't seen in a long time. And the conversation was just very fluid, very genuine. And we exchanged contact information. About 2 days later, I reached out because I knew I was leaving to head back to Atlanta the next day. And I just wanted to, you know, reconnect, maybe go out to dinner. And I reached out to him. He took a couple of hours to respond back. But once he did, I picked him up and went on a dinner date and then went to find a – I got a call about the apartment that I was looking at, and he rode with me to go see that, and I locked that in, and then the rest is history.
Yeah.
The next day I flew back to Atlanta. He flew to Rome, Italy for a vacation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then I got the job about a week later, and I packed my Mustang up, and I drove cross country, and the rest is history.
Sounds good. Wow. So when did you get into film early on in your life also?
Yeah, it was – well, I've always been – I'm one of 5, and in my household, I was the one that was getting in trouble because I'd leave the VHSs all over the wall unit. You know, we had our little 20-inch TV, and so it's always been.
For those of you who don't know, VHS is videotapes that don't exist anymore. Yeah. But a lot of the young people don't know what
they
that means.
Well, I was born in '89, so
well, you're young.
I'm from that world still.
Yeah,
but then, you know, as soon as it moved into like DVDs and they started doing like behind the scenes and commentary, then I really started to, you know, dive into what it is to make a movie, because you don't know unless you know someone in the business or you're exposed to it. So that was my first exposure to, oh, people make these and this is the extent of it.
Right.
So when I got into high school, I got an internship. I was part of a college prep program in my junior, senior year of high school.
Okay.
And that led me to this internship at what is now MBS. And yeah, I mean, I was it's funny. You look back and you think, you know, you're a kid and you have this dream. You want to be in movie. You want to be on sets and you want to whatever it is you want to do in the film industry. And I was just kind of living in a space where it didn't feel real because I'm on a film set and I'm on a film lot and I'm driving a golf cart. I'm doing the mail. I'm meeting people in productions.
Yeah. That's how you get started.
Yeah, it's like started room, at right? the very bottom. Yeah, sorting mail. But then it opened up opportunities where I could drop the mail off to the production companies. Okay. So David E. Kelly had his place there for Boston Public. Oh, wow. CSI Miami, that show Medium, The OC, these shows are long gone now, but America's Funniest Home Videos. So all these people knew me on a first name basis.
Oh, wow.
And then
so it's really a good way to get in, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Because you really get to meet everybody, really.
Oh, right? Yeah, everyone.
Even people that other people would meet that work there, but you're with the mail, it's like you have access to everyone pretty much.
Yeah.
Wow.
The program... It was actually designed for college students, but I was fortunate as the only high school student to be there. So it helped develop a work ethic for me because I was an intern.
Right.
I wasn't getting paid.
Right.
I was doing the work because it would benefit me with relationships and getting my foot started because I'm the first in my family to be in the business. I didn't have anyone to help open up that opportunity in my own network. So I had to create my own.
Right.
And that carried and helped all the way through film school. I went to Cal State Long Beach, graduated class of 2011.
Okay.
Which
what did like you graduate in? In
film? That was film, yeah. So I did their film program.
Okay.
Did
you graduate in film as well?
No, I graduated with a degree in social work.
Oh, wow. That's in University of Kentucky.
Yes, sir.
Oh, wow. So film for you came later on. But you were doing things when you were young.
Yeah, yeah. So okay, I was in front of the camera talent growing up. But, you know, recently transitioned to being behind the scenes, behind the camera as a creative, as a writer, executive producer.
Yeah. Wow, very cool. So you knew you wanted to do film early on in your life. You went to college for that. And you felt prepared and everything, right? Did you realize how difficult it is to get in?
Not necessarily difficult to get in because I had started so early and I was so fortunate to have that opportunity. I always worked and just built on the relationships that I had. Mm-hmm. So when I did graduate, I did get an internship, through a cinematographer, a wonderful DP named Byron Werner. And he brought me on as a camera PA for a movie called Phantom, with Ed Harrison, Dave Duchovny, and Lance Hendrickson. And so I went from graduating from film school to working on a real submarine.
Yeah.
And we shot this movie in San Diego in the harbor at the Maritime Museum. And so I didn't even know how to wrap BNC or properly handle lenses on that level. And digital cameras were just coming out. We shot on the Red Scarlet.
Right.
And it was like this boot camp.
Right.
A physical, mental, emotional, laborious job, but it was amazing. It was because we were making a movie, and we had these amazing actors. And
right. So you learned about filmmaking. Did you have any desire to be an actor as well?
No, it was never a desire necessarily to be an actor.
No, you wanted to actually be where it's being done, the big picture.
Well, I always had a love for camera and cinematography and then directing. Okay. Directing has always been my passion, for sure. It's always been the goal. And When I did that job, that was when the digital cameras were up on the rise and they moved out of the Red One into smaller camera bodies that were more efficient.
Right.
And that's where I met the DIT on that project. That specific role, the digital imaging technician, is the support and the right-hand person to the cinematographer.
Okay.
Who helps basically ensure like the integrity of the image because it's digital. It's not shooting film.
Right.
So there's so many nuances to digital. Quality control, exposure, color, just making sure there's a person who is assisting the DP and making sure the image is what they want.
Wow.
And so
you got to know a lot of things, obviously.
Yeah, it's very technical. And then you have to have an eye, too. There's a aesthetic that you have to hone and understand the visual language of cinematography and storytelling.
Right.
So, because you're working with the person who's responsible for that, the DP.
Right.
And so Sid Pineda was the DIT on that project. And I learned a lot from him. He, during that experience, I was exposed to something creative and technical. And from there, working with Byron Werner after that project, he'd bring me on to like download, because now it's not film. We have to, you know, manage the data from the camera. So I started in that space, and then we moved into like camera PAing, and I started learning about lenses and filters and workflow, and then studying color science data. It's a niche job that requires knowledge in so many different facets of filmmaking.
Sounds like it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to really know what you're doing. I mean,
yeah.
You know, and you have to answer to the DP.
Yeah.
You better know what you're doing. Right?
You are, and you are you're a pillar of support for not just the DP but the entire production. Because when you have a DIT, the importance of a DIT is to ensure efficiency and a consistent image throughout the entire process. That way, because digital is not film; it's very different. So we have to be able to manage what's happening in the camera from start to finish and making sure that things don't get lost and changed. There's so many different ways and possibilities for a look to change from a monitor to a camera to the editor. There's lots of places. So my job as the DIT when I'm working is to support and maintain that integrity.
Gotcha. Now, I always wondered about digital because, you know, I mean, they moved on from film.
Right.
And, you know, when you use a digital camera, I mean, it looks like video, right? Usually. I mean, how do they get that look of a film on a digital camera, or is it totally different?
Well, no, digital cameras, the professional cameras that we use are, you know, they have a latitude and a dynamic range that rivals that of film, sometimes even past that now.
Okay.
And, you know, coupled that with, you know, cinema lenses, whether they're large format or built for a 35, or they really elevate that look. You know, most of the things that you see on television are, it's all digital. Shooting with the Mary camera, the Venice,
right. But it's a different look on television, right?
Yeah, it depends. That's all aesthetic choices with the director and the DP.
Yeah.
And those are the things that I learned that helped me when I moved into this directing space.
Mm-hmm.
Because having that experience working with these incredible cinematographers, mm-hmm. I've learned from experience the language and how to achieve certain aspects of visual storytelling through working with these people and their gaffers and their key grips, and you know how to efficiently do that.
Right. Awesome. Now, so and you started in acting, right?
Correct.
And when you moved here, you were looking for jobs in acting. Did you have any desires to do things behind the scene at that point?
Honestly, Sam, I didn't. When I moved here, I still had an agent. I had two representations. I had representation in Atlanta still, and then I had representation here in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And I was just focused on what I was used to and what I loved. It was my passion. I think just performing and storytelling has always been ingrained in who I am and my identity, but I was first introduced to it through the path of acting.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing that for many years, and then I switched gears. I think that there is sometimes for every person, there's different plateaus that you reach. And I felt that for my career and experience within the acting realm, because I was doing it professionally since first grade.
Right.
I felt like I had reached my pinnacle of it. And I was okay with that. And I wanted to explore the other areas of my creativity, such as writing, because I've always been a passionate writer since I was a kid. I wanted to explore that and develop that more.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would start writing short stories. I would develop little pilots. And it got to a place where I started to find my voice as a writer. And when I presented stuff to my husband, Michael, he mm-hmm. was like, "This is great. You're a phenomenal writer." And it took us a couple years to decide to partner together because our schedules are very busy. You know, he works 12, 14-hour days once he's on a production. I worked in HR, you know, so our schedules don't align a lot.
Right.
But once they started to align, and it really happened right after the pandemic occurred, where we started to find some balance and some time of making ourselves available to explore our creative realms together, that's when we recognized that, okay, I think we might have something here. And, it's been a great ride so far.
Wow. And we'll talk about the films and all the work you did together. I'm curious about the HR. How did you get into that?
Man, like any other kid that just graduates from college, you're just trying to find a job.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing about me, I've always loved helping people. I think part of my spirit and purpose of being on this planet is to help people in any way, shape, or form.
So that's why you took social work in college.
It is. Yeah, that's why I have my degree in social work. And even with performing as an actor early on, just providing some type of entertainment to someone. It's just always been a part of who I am. And with social work and then transitioning into HR, I wanted to give people a way of providing for their families.
Right.
You know, and with helping people find jobs, build upon their careers. That gave me a lot of purpose. It made me feel like I'm contributing to a greater good other than myself, because it's incorporating and involving people's livelihoods and professions. And I love that to death. I think it's just such a great service to give to others in a way that's very profound.
Awesome. And do you have your own company, your own business?
I do. So I recently, within the past 4 years, I worked at Facebook, which is now called Meta.
Right.
And I resigned from that company in 2020 to start my own vision of what I think was wrong with hiring. And there's a lot of bias that occurs when you're trying to dissect who is the best person for the job. And bias can interfere with those decision-making processes in a negative way. And so I started a company called See Me, because the biggest problem is that a lot of people aren't seen for who they authentically are.
That's true.
And when it comes to the word See Me, it's really like see me for everything. See me for all of my qualities. See me outside of just being what you might consider a diversity hire, or someone that you would just hire because you're trying to fill a quota. It's just see me as a collective, as a whole. And so with building this startup, I really found the gaps that were occurring in hiring practices. And we have been implementing an app, a platform, where we're hiding and we're limiting a lot of biases from occurring when recruiters are reviewing candidates' profiles for job opportunities.
Okay.
So it's still underway. It's still in development. Nothing happens overnight. You know, the space of recruiting and hiring is constantly changing, and we're constantly having to evolve and, you know, implement better things on the platform. And it's a small team. I have a co-founder, a part of my team, and you know, it's a small venture, but it's a venture that I'm very proud of, and I'm looking forward to getting off the ground in due time.
So you guys do consulting to firms pretty much as far as HR and things like that?
I wouldn't say consulting. It's more so what we do. We look for partners within businesses, whether they're small businesses or macro businesses, and we say, hey, look, here's a platform, because a lot of companies use what's called an ATS system, and that's where applicants can apply directly to their website. The application goes into this big pot, this big pool, and they use a system called an ATS to help filter and to review resumes and applications. But when that happens, a lot of times that's where the bias occurs, and you have social media that you implement on top of that, and even more bias occurs.
Uh-huh.
So our platform, See Me, helps with reducing and limiting all that scope of visibility,
mm-hmm.
And giving you direct interaction, the job seeker with the recruiter, and not knowing a lot of things about that person that can create bias. And it's also mm-hmm. on the job seeker site, because what we recognize is that there's also bias that occurs from the job seeker when they're looking for jobs.
Yeah.
If you have a company, let's say like Facebook, that's reaching out to you compared to a smaller scale company that's reaching out, more than likely the bigger name company is going to get more applicants, is going to get more communication from the job seekers.
Right.
But that smaller company might be the right fit for you.
Exactly. A better platform for you to grow.
Exactly.
Wow. Very cool. You know, I mean, that's like a very innovative thing that I think is definitely necessary. I mean, you know, it's like, so from what I understand from you, it's sort of like, don't look at me as like what I am rather than who I am.
Exactly.
Right?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Very cool, man.
Thank you.
But I wish you a lot of success in that. You
Thank
know,
you,
I
Sam.
Mean, it's like, it is helping people and, you know, people can use that, you know, because, like you said, in hiring, there's a lot that's going on, you know, and people don't even realize that. But when you bring it up, it makes a lot of sense, you know. Yeah. Wow. So the next step, did you get to do anything behind the scenes before you met Michael?
Let me think. There was a time when I was at home in college for the summer. I would do some PA work on mm-hmm. some local Atlanta productions, because Atlanta's like the second Hollywood in terms of things that are filming there.
Oh, wow. That's
and,
interesting.
Yeah, I did a PA job on Footloose, the remake of it,
uh-huh.
several years back, and then I was a background extra in one of the Halloween movies that Rob Zombie directed. Mm-hmm. And that was about it. That was my experience of just being more so like behind the scenes, not so much in front of the camera.
Right. Yeah. Awesome. So you guys met. Did you realize quickly that you guys had things in common as far as your careers and your interests and things like that?
Absolutely, yeah. It was like meeting an old friend, and a lot of our interests and what we – just in general, what we valued – We're very aligned.
Yeah. It was right. Like, so I imagine it didn't take you a long time to decide, let's collaborate and work together.
No, no. And in fact, you know, since I grew up behind the camera, so I would often educate anything that would he would ask a question about, we'd watch a movie, I would just kind of divulge into how it was done, whether it be lighting or camera movement or the process. I start, you know, talking about like the flow of set and who does what in terms of what position and how it's a collaborative process. And so, but that's just me talking during movies and talking too much during movies, because we like to, us filmmakers, we like to break down movies so much to the point where it kills the experience for the person who's like,
But that's interesting, you know, because I often wonder, how can people handle such a big project, you know, like with the blockbusters and stuff where there's so much work to do? And then I realize it's just like a business, you know. I mean, company. Everybody has their role, and then you put it together.
Yeah.
But the director has to be in charge of everything and to understand how everything works.
Right. The director is the captain, but the director also, just like in any company, you know, you have someone helping you with logistics, like a very solid producer or a team of producers. And from there, the director will bring on the creatives, who will then hire their teams to support their each department.
Right.
But the director, you know, you have to trust the folks that you hire, the folks that you bring in.
And you're managing a lot of people, obviously.
It's a lot of management. And then as soon as you trust the folks that are doing all the creative in the creative departments, whether it be art department or costumes, wardrobe, makeup, hair, production design, camera, then your primary focus is, you know, what's happening in the scene with your actor.
Right.
So working with them. So I felt like in the space, as soon as I threw this director's hat on, I felt very confident because I brought in a lot of folks that I've collaborated with over the years in television and in film. So I had that support that I've been so used to. Even when I wasn't the director, I'm the DIT, but I had this relationship, and I've been working with cinematographers and gaffers and, you know, art department, and even in directors would come to the space where it's the DIT tent as well, just fostering those relationships and then just taking note and absorbing, by witnessing, you know, the rehearsals.
Right.
And then just having conversations with the DPs and the directors about, you know, what makes this better? How would this be more efficient? You know,
right.
Questioning everything and then being in a space where you could get feedback and you can get that advice from these masters of their crafts. And I just brought that to the table when it was my turn to wear the hat. And having the support of all these department heads allow me to focus on the actors and the performances.
Right. And do you remember the first film you made?
The first film. This is my first.
This
film
is your first one.
This is the first.
Oh wow!
First one.
It's called "Will I See You Again?" And we're going to discuss that. So that's your first film.
Correct.
Wow! Congratulations! Thank you. Already you're up for awards and things like that, right?
Well, we just world premiered at the Holly Shorts Film Festival.
The Holly Shorts started a few days ago, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
We premiered on Friday night. It was wonderful. We had a great turnout, and it was a magical experience to sit in a theater of that size. And, you know, it's at the Chinese Theater 6 on Hollywood Boulevard. So it's, you know, it's a standard quality theater that you would get the highest quality you can get. And to be in that and see it on that screen and hear, absorb the audience.
Audience and stuff.
Yeah, that's what's an amazing thing.
It's so rewarding.
It's incredible.
I bet. And you wrote the screenplay for this film.
Correct, yeah.
When did you write it? Was it long before?
No. This is an honest, true story, Sam. So we went camping at Yosemite with a couple of friends and family members back in October of 2023. And we got back from that camping trip, and probably like a week later, Mike, he just came to me and said, hey, look, I'm about to go work out and run some errands. And I was staying home. He's like, I want to come up with a story. I just come up with something unique. And I said, okay, I can do that. Mm-hmm. So he was gone for about 4 hours, and I was sitting. And what I like to do with my process, I always like to implement some type of, like, experience from my own life or inspiration from my own experiences mm-hmm. into my storytelling. And I thought deep about what's something that is so universal for everyone. Mm-hmm. And that would be wanting closure. A lot of people might not get closure in different circumstances and situations. And there's a longing for that. And that's a language and a feeling that's universally understood. So once mm-hmm. I had that in mind, I said, okay, well, how can we tell a story that involves someone seeking closure or people seeking closure? And I wrote the story out. I came up with this story about Max and Paul and their circumstances and their situation. And then he got home and I presented the story to him. And he said, oh, my God, this is genius. Like, I love this. And he said, you should try to write a script. Uh-huh. And I had never wrote a script before, mind you.
Really?
Never wrote a script before.
Wow.
And so once we bought the software for the scripting format, he showed me just how to, you know, just how to use the proper formatting of it. And then he said, hey, I want you to just try it. You can do this. And I was intimidated. I have to admit I was, because I had not done that before. I was just used to writing stories. Mm-hmm. And once I started to break down a script, because I was familiar with how scripts were broken down. Luckily, from my acting experience, I knew how scripts were formatted. I knew how beats were. I knew the dialogue and how you have to minimize certain things, not be so exponential and with your storytelling of writing actual dialogue and not telling the story in the script.
Right.
And so once I presented the first draft, he said, oh, dude, this is great. And so what we did, we said, we got to make this. This is divine. We have to make this together. And we partnered on just polishing up further drafts of the scripts mm-hmm. and really tightening up the story and the characters.
Yeah. The few weeks that followed that, we went through a number of drafts.
Yeah.
And then with that, had some very experienced colleagues just, you know, take a look and give us that affirmation of, like, you guys need to do this.
Yeah.
Really?
Two mentors of mine read it, and they were, you know, they're directors and writers. And they said, yeah, you're ready. I think you guys have something really, really, really profound here.
Wow.
So by that time, Sam, mm-hmm. it was early November yeah. of 2023. Mm-hmm. And I kid you not, we went from having a shooting draft script to finding these two amazing producers, Valeria Lopez and Alex Coffey, that we sent the script to. They loved it. They said, we want to hop on board. We would love to produce this for you guys. Mm-hmm. So we got the producers in the second week of November. They ended up hiring the amazing Tinica Becker, who's our casting director. Mm-hmm. She came on board because she loved the script. She said, I think this is incredible. I can find the right actors and help you guys with this.
Yeah.
And so she came on board. We went into preliminary pre-casting by end of November to mid-December. Mm-hmm. Found our actors, went into pre-production through mid-December to end December, and we shot the first week of January 2024.
Yeah, wow. 3 days.
And 3 days.
January 5, 6, and 7.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Did you set out to make a short film? Or,
oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You did. You knew that's what you wanted to do?
Yeah.
Because it's a lot easier as the first film,
it's
no?
It's not. In general. It's not as easy. It's
right.
just as hard as make as a feature.
Right. No, I mean, I figured you have to tell a story in a short time.
Yeah, that's the challenge.
And that's the challenge, right?
Yes, yeah. It is.
You don't have as much time. But a full feature, I mean, that's a longer process with, right? And things like that.
Right.
That's what I meant, yeah.
Right.
But nevertheless, you undertook this project. So tell us a little bit about the story. What is it about? You got to be curious now.
Yeah, yeah. So after 20 years of estrangement, two former college teammates find themselves summoned to their late friend's estate hearing. But to claim their inheritance, they must first confront their past relationship while connected to a polygraph machine.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is like, so they stand to get some money out of all this?
We don't want to give away what it is. They stand to receive
an inheritance.
Yes. Correct.
Yes. Inheritance, okay. Correct. Yeah. Okay, well, don't tell us everything. You see, that's why I don't watch it before, because I don't want to give away what you guys don't want to give away, you know? But so how did the story come about? I mean, you said you were looking for something like closure and stuff, but how did you think about this specific thing?
Yeah, I was in college at the University of Kentucky, and I graduated in 2014. And doing my time there, I just had my own experiences with first love and love and loss, and how when the loss happens, if you don't have an answer as to why, it can weigh on you and it can carry with you. You don't get your closure or this idea of what closure looks like for you. And I think through recognizing that that was a universal thing and experience that a lot of people have is wanting to seek closure, I just tapped into what that would look like where you have two people that live separate lives. Mm-hmm. So many years have passed. And what can bring them back together without them wanting to seek the closure themselves?
I see. Okay.
And so with the death of the friend, the mutual friend that they went to college with, he, in his will, set up this experience for them to talk it out. They I have see. To face each other.
Wow.
And I think to your point about like a money inheritance, what would draw someone to even want to participate in a polygraph, even if it is from a close friend that had passed?
Right.
And there is always this incentive that's over people's head of, well, is it this money or am I inheriting something? I can go through it. And so I wanted that to help push our lead characters into wanting to experience and go through this experience of the polygraph, because instinctually a lot of humans, you know, we're greedy. And you know, when there's something that you want to inherit.
Right. Or, you know, someone that meant something to you, whether it be from, you know, you kept in contact with or you did have a relationship with, if you felt, you know, it's an honor to have to be recognized and say, I'd like to leave something for you. It doesn't have to be monetary. It could be an asset of sentiment. So you're going to get curious with that.
Yeah.
And our story brings these two men into a space, and it's unexpected. So it sets, it sets them on this journey that they didn't think would happen.
Yeah. Well, I would think it's unexpected to have to be asked to go on a polygraph machine and actually, you know, find out that you tell the truth, you know.
And so there's a romanticism behind a polygraph, as it is, I think. Yeah. And it's an analog polygraph. It's from the 70s, and we had two of them. We had a wonderful polygraph technician come out.
So this is based in the 70s, the movie itself?
No. It's set in modern day, but the polygraph machines are authentic, antique.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
How come you did that and not with the modern machines?
I think it's a little more for the sake of visual storytelling.
Okay.
Seeing a needle move and the ink come on it is a little more dramatic than a screen that looks like a heart rate monitor.
That's,
you know what
true.
I mean?
Yeah,
it's its own
character.
It's true.
Because we envision something.
Yeah.
It brings up something when you see that machine.
It's something physical.
Yeah.
So when something moves physically instead of on a screen, it's a character in the story. And we had a wonderful sound designer, Fred Helms, come in and elevate and make it its own character in the room. It's like a living, breathing thing that amplifies and puts pressure on these two, and the audience too. So it worked out really well.
Because they can actually see what's going on.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
That's clever, you know. I mean, that's really cool. So you actually gave it some thought. And so originally, did you think we're going to have like modern machines, or did you right away?
No, I knew right away. When I wrote the story and the script, I knew right away that this would be an authentic polygraph machine.
I see.
Yeah.
Gotcha. How long is the film?
It's about 24 minutes from 24? Start to finish, yeah.
And that's kind of long for short film, no? How long are they usually?
Well, a short film is defined by festivals, but it's generally accepted as 39 minutes and 59 seconds and under is a short film. Anything longer than that is a feature film.
So it can be up to 39 minutes?
Correct.
Oh, wow, I didn't realize that.
Technically, 40 minutes is the max per Academy bylaws, but and you want to keep it under that. Anything above 40 minutes is considered a feature film.
Right. I see. Okay.
Right.
Wow.
Right. So we originally, our first cut was like 28 minutes, I think.
Yeah.
So we had shaved down some things just to make the story flow. It was really a pacing thing because that's what's important when you're telling a story that's shorter than a feature. You want to make sure that the pacing feels, you can't feel it.
Yeah.
You're so involved in the story and invested that time, you're not looking at your watch,
right?
And that's an important thing in a short that I learned. And you know, you have to make sacrifices, unfortunately, in certain cases, because you spend so much time writing and you take your time, you know, filming it and the whole crew, and you fall in love with what you have. But for the end result to be as efficient and effective as possible in this short amount of time, you really have to edit in a way that is seamless for the audience. That way you can, because you can watch something that's maybe 8 minutes and it feels like 18 minutes.
Right.
But one of the most wonderful comments that I would get when we did our, as soon as we locked the edit, people said, oh, it doesn't feel like 24 minutes. It felt shorter than that.
It went quickly because they're into the, into what's going on in the film.
And the story is very tight in terms of how the characters are interacting, what's being said, the shots that are being seen. Everything had to be intentional. We don't have any fluff, at least in my opinion. I don't think we have any fluff room in this story, in this short, because time is of the essence. We as filmmakers wanted to challenge ourselves. We don't settle for less. We really worked hard on making sure that this story was so fine-tuned that people would be on the edge of their seats. And luckily, we've received feedback, especially from just outside critics, film critics that have reviewed the film privately, that have just sung our praises and given this film their accolades.
That's amazing. When you write the screenplay, do you know about how long the film's going to be?
Yeah, so about a minute, a page is about, one page is about a minute.
Right.
So when we had the script done, I believe we were on what, Michael, 16 pages?
Well, we were on 14 pages. And that is true most of the time. But as soon as the director, I wanted to let the space breathe, the interactions, have the actors and the audience living this experience, seeing it on screen. You have to, because the movie is such an intimate movie, and when things happen and things are said, especially in the polygraph situation when we're asking questions, I stretched that a lot longer than the page count would give. You know, the page count would technically say, oh, your movie should be about 15 minutes. But because of the dynamic of the edit and its effectiveness to elevate emotional intensity, we went much further than the page count would.
Like more drama.
It's the only way it could have been done. So it's a rule. Page per minute in a lot of times in television and in features. But in this case, we had to do it this way.
Amazing. Did you have a large cast? How many people in the cast?
Eight people.
And you had a casting director.
Correct.
But you guys obviously were involved in the casting as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. My husband and I were the creative decision makers in this entire process.
Right.
And we collaborate so well together. 99.9 times. We were always in sync with what we wanted. And we had discussions about what the idea of the type of actors we wanted to play. And then you bring that to your casting director, and Tinica she's a genius. She already had a few ideas, and she started presenting cast members to us. And Nick Wexler was one of the earlier ones that she presented, and he set the bar so high because he's a phenomenal actor, and he's an expert at his craft, and he's an amazing person. He's just the sweetest person ever. That audition that he did blew our mind.
And he didn't have to do that audition. No. So what happened was when Tinica, she reached out to him because she just knew that on a level of talent, he was perfect to read this role. And she just sent him the script. He fell in love with the script. He fell in love with the character. And he said, hey, look, I voluntarily want to go on camera for these young filmmakers because I want them to see how passionate I want this role. He's someone that doesn't have to audition. You know, he worked for many years. He was on ABC's Revenge as the lead. He's done so much work. So we were very humbled to see that someone of his caliber, of his stature, was willing to even go on camera. And as soon as we saw that tape, I woke Michael up. It was around 11:30 at night. I was in bed on my computer checking stuff. And the email came through from Tinica. And I watched it. And I said, Michael, you have to get up right now. You have to watch this audition. And
I thought I was dreaming. I was like, this is incredible.
Really?
Is this real? And we met him for lunch, and he was just an amazing person.
That's cool. So you were very fortunate.
Oh, my gosh.
Right.
And we had already had a couple, just through our own relationships with a few actors, that are in the film.
Who are some of the people in the film?
So Rosanny Zayas, she plays Jessica. She's one of the polygraph interpreters.
Okay.
And her and I have been friends for years because I did a show called L Word Generation Q. Mm-hmm. So that ran for 3 seasons. And so we had already had a relationship. We were friends on set. And right. So I sent her the script. And I just texted her. I was like, hey, check this out. And she's like, oh, my God, I love this. I'm available. Let's do it. So that was wonderful to have her support because yeah. She's so phenomenal. She's an incredible actress. And
right.
She was available. A lot of times it's timing. Like if someone, am I in town? I'm already working. So right. We're very fortunate for that. And then
right. My
husband already knew Richard Lawson, a mentor of his. He's on his board of advisors for his startup, and mm-hmm. he's always been there for him.
Yeah.
And that was another quick text message. Yep. Sent him the script, loved it. He's like, yeah, let's do it. Let's wow. let's work out, you know, timing and whatnot. And
so things fell into place pretty nicely
they
for
did.
You,
pretty
Sam, smoothly. They really did.
Wow, yeah. You're very fortunate at that. You
we
know?
Are.
I mean,
yeah, we count our blessings on that because it's hard to make a movie.
Yeah.
And I commend anyone trying to – who does make a movie. Yeah. Trying to make a movie, absolutely. And then if you could accomplish that,
right?
It's very difficult.
It is.
You
amazing.
Need a team, an army to do it. And we're very fortunate
very
to have
fortunate
all these.
Very fortunate for all our producers, all our executive producers, mm-hmm. investors, cast, crew. It was a big family production in terms of a village. It took a village to get us to the finish line, and we're just extremely grateful for everyone that had a hand in that.
Well, yeah. Congratulations to you. I mean, it's like... It's a big deal, you know. I mean, it's a big deal to finish a movie and actually have a body of work, you know, that you're proud of. Have you shown it at any festivals yet except Holly Shorts?
No, Holly Shorts was our world premiere. So
okay.
We had Holly Shorts. And then we will – next, we've been selected by the Bronze Lens Film Festival in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh.
So that's in a week and a half.
It's in a week.
In
wow.
a week. Yeah, in a week.
So you get to go home and
get
stuff.
To go home, exactly. And then we have another festival in Atlanta about a month later called Out on Film,
uh-huh.
Atlanta's LGBTQ festival. And
yep.
All three of these festivals, Holly Shorts, Bronze Lens, and Out on Film, they're all Oscar-qualifying festivals. So just to be recognized on that level as first-time filmmakers, to see that our quality of work in this short film is being revered and chosen and selected officially mm-hmm. for these highly esteemed festivals is truly an honor, and we're just extremely grateful.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you still have a chance to get into the Oscars, right?
We do.
Yeah.
We do.
How does that happen? How do they choose which ones? There's like a committee or something?
So every festival has a select group of jury members that mm-hmm. they bring on to review the films that were selected. And there's like a voting system that happens. And then within that, on the last day usually of any festival, they'll announce an award ceremony and who the winners are. And every festival that's Oscar qualifying has a grand jury prize award. And that's what's the winning award under the Academy that's deemed recognizable as. Okay, great. Now you can apply officially to the Academy for consideration for the Oscars. Yeah, so that's how that works.
Wow. How many people get nominated? Is it 10?
So normally,
it used to be 5, no?
So normally what it is when you submit, there's around on average 187 films that qualify for Oscar consideration. And then the next step is when there's a shortlist. And there's usually 15 films that are on the shortlist. And then from the shortlist, there's 5 for nominations.
5.
Yeah.
Okay, wow. That's a long road, but you should be able to do that. I mean, you know, I mean, you got a good film and you got a lot of desire and drive and stuff. And I don't see why not, you know. So we wish you all the best, really. I mean, you know, I'd love to see you win an Oscar and everything, you know. I mean,
thank you, Sam.
Why not, you know. And I can tell you that Catherine had some clients that did go to the Oscars. And I felt good, you know, because here I see them and they were on my show, you know. So,
yeah, exactly.
So there you go. You know, you have a good good opportunity there. Well, that's great. You know, the movie is Will I See You Again? Where, if people want to see it, how can they see it?
So we actually have one more film festival that is taking place in Los Angeles. It's end of October. It's called the Michaux Film Festival, M-I-C-H-A-E. AEUX. So that's the film festival. So that'll be in Culver City.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's at the Culver Theater.
Okay. So if you guys look it up, you'll probably be able to find
it,
right? Yeah.
Follow the Instagram. It's at WIYSA Film.
Okay.
So it's the acronym for the movie,
Film.
Okay. And then we'll be posting most of that stuff, keeping people updated of where it's going to be, screening, you know, how it's going.
Yeah. Do you have a website or social media for the movie?
The website is www.williseeyouagain.com.
Sounds good. That's simple enough.
Yeah.
Everybody go out and check out the movie. I'm going to go home and watch it now because, you see, now I'm curious. And that's why I like to watch the movie after the interviews, because now I really want to see what you guys put together, you know, because now I'm familiar with the film, you know. Right. So that's very good. Well, Rhett Lindsay and Michael Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us. You guys are great.
Thank you so much.
And I wish you all the best, really. I mean, you guys deserve it. And much more success. Come back when you have more films, you know?
Absolutely.
I'd love to see that.
Sounds good.
Thank you,
okay.
Sam.
Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.